Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Michael Hatton discusses Parshat Re'eh. Michael Hatton is a faculty member at Pardes, specializing in Chumash. And now, Michael Hatton.
Thank you, Larry. Parshat Re'eh, the central shrine. Parshat Re'eh begins with additional rites to be fulfilled when the people of Israel enter the land, and constitutes the effective beginning of Moshe's explication of the laws. First, Moshe instructs the people that the blessings and curses are to be administered as they assemble according to tribe in the valley between Mount Gerizim and Mount Eval, after their arrival in the land, and there the war against idolatry and immorality is to be formally initiated. Moshe goes on to again warn the people not to succumb to the attractions of polytheism, cautioning them to instead wipe out any traces of its widespread worship so that the true God can be served faithfully. In glaring contrast to the rampant service of idols that takes place on the high mountains and hills and under every leafy tree, the worship of the God of Israel is to be confined to one central temple, whose location God will choose. In consonance with the revolutionary idea of a single absolute deity, there is to be a single unequivocal sanctuary where that God is to be served. There you shall bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and donations, your vows and freewill offerings, the firstborn of your cattle and sheep. No local sacrificial shrines are to be erected to God's service. For although prayer is deemed efficacious at every location, sacrifice is an affront when practiced outside of the temple's precincts. Moshe reinforces his polemic against idolatry with a subsequent series of extreme pronouncements directed against the false prophet, the inciter, and the city led astray. In all three cases, the elements responsible for the idolatrous undoing are to be destroyed, as the message is forcefully driven home that idol worship cannot be sanctioned. The parsha then turns to the subject of holiness and, concerning consumption, discusses the permitted and forbidden creatures. Then, agricultural laws are explicated, as the rituals of the second tithe and the principles of the Shemitah cycles are spelled out. In both instances, it is the overarching moral implications of the observances that are highlighted. The poor shall not cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall surely open your hand to your poor relation or countryman. Finally, the seasonal holiday cycle of the three pilgrim festivals of Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot is described. And the parsha concludes much as it began, with a mention of the necessity for a single central shrine. Three times a year shall all of your males appear before God your Lord at the location that he shall choose. What exactly is the necessity of ensuring the operation of only one central location for the worship of God through sacrifice? Why is the Torah so adamant that no offerings are to be presented outside of the confines of the temple? Certainly, the requirement constituted a fundamental break with prevailing polytheistic practice that tended to celebrate a myriad of sacrificial worship sites scattered the length and breadth of the land. This was especially true in the land of Canaan, where a varied topography and highly heterogeneous landscapes tended to encourage regional outlooks, whether in politics, commerce, or religion. Of course, we tend to draw a straight thematic line from the portable Mishkan in the wilderness to the permanent temple at Jerusalem, as if the Torah's insistence that sacrificial worship be confined to a single location was forever part and parcel of Israel's biblical history. A careful reading of the biblical narratives, however, reveals a more complex picture, as the following lengthy citation from the Mishnah, Tractate Zvachim, Chapter 14 illustrates. The Mishnah states, before the Mishkan was erected, sacrifice upon the high places was permitted, and the service was performed by the firstborn. After the establishment of the Mishkan, however, the high places were forbidden, and the service was performed by the Kohanim. The most holy sacrifices could be eaten only within its perimeter curtains, while sacrifices of lesser sanctity could be consumed anywhere within the Israelite encampment. When the people came to Gilgal, the high places were again permitted. The most holy sacrifices could be eaten only within the perimeter curtains of the Mishkan, while sacrifices of lesser sanctity could be consumed anywhere. When the people came to Shiloh, the high places were forbidden. At Shiloh, the Mishkan had no ceiling. It was provided with walls of stone below, while the covering above was made of curtains, and it constituted the resting place, the Minucha. The most holy sacrifices could be eaten only within its perimeter curtains, while sacrifices of lesser sanctity, as well as second tithe, could be consumed anywhere within its field of vision. When the people came to Nov and to Giv'on, sacrifice upon the high places was again permitted. The most holy sacrifices could be eaten only within the perimeter curtains, while sacrifices of lesser sanctity could be consumed among any of the cities of Israel. When the people came to Jerusalem, the high places were again forbidden and were never permitted again, for it constituted the inheritance, or Nachala. The most holy sacrifices could be eaten only within the perimeter walls of the Temple Mount, while sacrifices of lesser sanctity and second tithe could be consumed only within the city wall. The Mishnah here describes a number of related issues that require elaboration. In pre-Mishkan days, and dating back to the beginnings of Hebrew Israelite history, there was no central sanctuary for the people of Israel, and sacrifice could be offered to God at any location. These so-called high places, or bamot, were often no more than makeshift altars that would typically be imposingly located upon the summits of hills or other elevations, while the sacrificial service associated with them would entail little in the way of formal ritual or mandated ceremonial. Any family could take an active part in the ceremony through the agency of their firstborn, who would perform the requisite rites. The patriarchal narratives of Sefer Bereshit reveal just such a reality, for everywhere the patriarchs are described as building makeshift altars and offering spontaneous sacrifice to God. The situation changed dramatically with the completion of the Mishkan about a year after the Exodus, during the beginning of the wilderness sojourn. This building and its appurtenances, described in exhaustive detail in the second half of Sefer Shmot, ushered in a new period in Israel's religious development. Henceforth, the sacrificial service became a centralized affair, carried out under the rigorous and exclusive jurisdiction of the Kohanim, the priests who descend from Aharon. This revolutionary reformation had the welcome result of putting an end to informal and unofficial sacrificial services that were more often than not devoted to idolatrous worship rather than to the homage of the one true God. As well, the institution of the Mishkan was an important tool for the unification of the desert tribes, who now rallied around a single central sanctuary. After the people left the wilderness and crossed into Canaan under the leadership of Yehoshua in the 13th century BCE, the high places were paradoxically again permitted, at least as long as the Mishkan was sited at Gilgal and the wars of conquest were being waged. Now Gilgal, just west of the River Jordan and opposite the city of Jericho, was the place where Israel first encamped after they had crossed the swollen waters of the Jordan on a radiant spring day some 40 years after the Exodus. At Gilgal, the people of Israel renewed the rite of circumcision. There they celebrated their first Passover in the new land, and during the course of the wars of conquest, they always returned to Gilgal to regroup. Although sacrifice upon the high places was permitted while the Mishkan stood at Gilgal, the centrality of the national shrine was nevertheless preserved by the stipulation that certain grades of sacrifices, the most sanctified, could only be offered and consumed within its boundaries. Eventually, towards the end of Yehoshua's lifetime, after the tribal portions of Yehuda and Yosef had been apportioned, and with the rest of the territories soon to be allotted by the aged leader, the people of Israel established the Mishkan at Shiloh, as the text in the book of Joshua chapter 18 relates. The entire congregation of Israel gathered at Shiloh, and there they set up the tent of meeting, for the land was conquered before them. There remained 7 tribes from among the people of Israel who had not apportioned their territories. Yehoshua cast lots for them in Shiloh before God, and there Yehoshua divided the land for the people of Israel according to their tribal divisions. The town of Shiloh, located some 30 kilometers northeast of Jerusalem, is nestled in the scenic highlands of Ephraim, among the rugged hills that form the topographical backbone of the land of Canaan. At that time of the Mishkan's relocation, the high places were again forbidden, and the Shiloh sanctuary became the only acceptable venue for the sacrificial service. Also, as the people planted crops in the new land and harvested the produce of their fertile fields, the practice of the second tithe, a portion of the crop separated every first, second, fourth, and fifth years of the agricultural cycle, to be brought and consumed in the proximity of the Mishkan, began. In the end, the sanctuary at Shiloh was destroyed by the Philistines, a traumatic event described in the opening chapters of Sefer Shemuel, an event that ushered in a period of intense instability. Eventually, the sanctuary was reestablished, first at Nov and later at Giv'on, and during this time, the high places were again permitted. Finally, the temple was built at Jerusalem by Shlomo, King Solomon, and worship upon the high places was discontinued forever. The sweep of national history, concisely described by these Mishnayot then, from the aftermath of the Exodus until the building of the temple, corresponds to a period of over 400 years, and includes some of the most pivotal moments in biblical history: the Exodus, the entry into Canaan, the conquest of the land and the beginning of the settlement, the period of the judges, and the dawn of the monarchy. According to the traditional chronology, the Mishkan stood at Gilgal for 14 years, at Shiloh for 369 years, and at Nov and Giv'on for 57 years. Taking into account the 40 years of the wanderings in the wilderness, a total of 480 years therefore elapsed from the Exodus until the building of the temple at Jerusalem, just as recorded in the Book of Kings 1, chapter 6, verse 1. Interestingly, the Mishnah was not content to simply describe the ritual ramifications of the Mishkan's peregrinations, but described its architectural progressions as well. The Mishnah stated, at Shiloh the Mishkan had no ceiling. It was provided with walls of stone below, while the covering above was made of curtains. In other words, before Shiloh, the Mishkan was exclusively a temporary tent-like structure, as the Exodus narratives describe. Its walls were made of gilded boards of acacia wood that were disassembled and reassembled at every encampment in the wilderness, and its covering consisted of a series of curtains and animal hides that provided it with a most tent-like quality. Hence, The Torah often refers to it as the Tent of Meeting, or Ohel Moed. Once established at Shiloh, however, the temporary prefabricated walls of acacia wood, previously fastened together by an ingenious combination of golden bars and rings, were stored away forever. And the walls of the Mishkan were built instead out of stalwart stone. The cover of textiles and skins, however, was retained. At Jerusalem, in contrast, the temple structure was provided with permanent walls of stone, as well as with a sturdy roof of cedar timbers, extravagantly covered on the interior with pure gold, as related in the Book of Kings 1, chapter 6, verses 9 and 22. Considering this architectural narrative carefully, a startling observation emerges. The developments in the building envelope of the Mishkan perfectly parallel the national story of the people of Israel as they experience the process of securing permanent settlements in the land. In other words, as long as the people of Israel were confined to the wilderness, the Mishkan was an exclusively temporary affair that reflected their condition. But as soon as they entered the land and embarked on the wars of conquest, a transitional stage of development was introduced, full of national uncertainty and precariousness, and underscored in the life of the tent-like Mishkan by the temporary suspension of the ban on sacrifice at the high places. Eventually, after Yehoshua completed the initial wars of conquest, the Mishkan was established at Shiloh, but this time as a sanctuary, taking on the trappings of permanence. Hence, while the tent-like and temporary cover was preserved, the walls were fashioned out of stone, to indicate that the people of Israel had achieved an important milestone in their national development. They had succeeded in entering the land and had started to strike down roots in its fertile red earth. Historically, the period of Shiloh corresponded to the rule of the judges, a tenuous area of transition in which central authority was lacking, external threats were myriad, and tribal unity was still an unrealized dream. But the unstoppable process of securing the land, though plagued by setbacks and struggles, was nevertheless underway. In the end, the Mishkan at Shiloh was destroyed by the Philistines, a technologically more advanced but morally primitive coastal people who opposed the Israelite advance at every step. For a time, instability reigned until the prophet Samuel arose to guide the people and to later lay the groundwork for the establishment of the monarchy. At this time, the Mishkan was again temporary, now at Nov, then at Giv'on, as first King Saul, and finally David ascended to the throne. In the meantime, the high places returned to vogue, as the provisional character of the era, as well as its dangerous instability, were highlighted. It was David who finally succeeded in both unifying the tribes and neutralizing their enemies, eventually founding the national capital at Jerusalem and initiating the process of building the temple. Shlomo his son built that edifice upon sacred Mount Moriah as the prolonged odyssey of the people of Israel finally came to an end. The national stability, unity of purpose, security from external threats, and cultural ascendancy that Israel enjoyed during the brief period of his reign corresponded to the building of the temple, a building that was structurally permanent in every sense of the term. Once again, the fortunes of the people were perfectly mirrored by the fate of their holy place, for towering above Jerusalem, the temple now told the story of Israel finally achieving immovability and rootedness in their land. Actually, the connection between the Mishkan and the process of settlement should not be that surprising. as the expression of the potential for God's abode on earth among the people of Israel, the fortunes of the Mishkan ought to reflect the travails and triumphs of the Jewish nation. As surely as God's presence is among them, and his concern is never far removed, the Mishkan and temple duplicate their destiny. No wonder that in the biblical frame of reference, the exile of the nation of Israel from its land and the promise of their eventual restoration were inextricably twinned with the destruction of the temple on the one hand and the prophetic vision of its ultimate rebuilding on the other. And thus it is that our ancient yearning for the temple's reestablishment upon its holy mountain, never entirely extirpated, even by exile's harsh travails, from the national Jewish heart, ultimately corresponds to our eternal longing for complete reconciliation with the God of Israel. To complete the picture, we must note that these epochs of Israel's biblical history closely follow the chronological outline of the prophetic books of the Tanakh. Sefer Yehoshua, the book of Joshua, is almost entirely transitional. The narratives told within its pages therefore correspond to the Mishkan leaving the wilderness, arriving at Gilgal, and, towards the end of the book, finally arriving at Shiloh, as the settlement drive begins in earnest. The events of Sefer Shoftim, the book of Judges, full as they are of the painful struggle to found a nation and united around its mission mandated by God, all take place while the Mishkan stands at Shiloh, more established and secure than before, but vulnerable nonetheless. The book of Samuel opens with the Mishkan's destruction, as the uncertain and perilous passage from the rule of the judges to the founding of the monarchy unfolds. Without exception, the events of the book transpire while the Mishkan is temporarily located, first at Nov, and then at Giv'on. All the while, as the rival high places enjoy a resurgence, a direct expression of the uncertainty of the times. Finally, the Book of Kings begins with the ascent of Solomon to the throne. Full of talent, charged with spiritual ambition, thoughtful enough to make good use of all of his father David's thorough preparatory work, Shlomo quickly consolidates his rule and then embarks upon the most memorable accomplishment of his illustrious reign, the building of the temple at Jerusalem. The remainder of the Book of Kings, of course, is bound up with the physical fortunes of this edifice. When the people of Israel are exiled to the rivers of Babylon, at the book's conclusion, the temple is razed to the ground. This Shiloh Jerusalem nixis, representing two distinct but linked stages of national consolidation, the beginning of settlement on the one hand and the securing of permanence on the other, is suggested by an illuminating verse from this week's Parsha that holds the key to comprehending the matter. As Moshe prepares to take his leave of the people forever, he again exhorts them to follow God's commands and encourages them to remain steadfast in the new land. As related in Devarim chapter 12, "Do not do as all of us now do here today, everyone as he sees fit in his own eyes. For you have not yet arrived at the state of rest, minucha, or inheritance, nachala, that God your Lord gives to you. You shall traverse the river Jordan and dwell in the land that God your Lord causes you to possess, and he will grant you rest from all of your enemies around, and you shall dwell in security. Then, at the place that God your Lord shall choose to cause his name to dwell there, you shall present all that I command you, your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and dues, and all of your best vow offerings that you shall promise to God." Moshe tells the people that although the process of settling the land will be drawn out and difficult, mirrored by the relaxation of the Torah's prohibition concerning the high places, one day they shall enjoy national peace and tranquility, and at that time they will build a sanctuary to God and serve him there exclusively. One day they will achieve the state of rest, or minucha, and inheritance, nachala, that will be the natural precursors to the securing of a viable and permanent state, ultimately reflected by the establishment of an enduring edifice to God's glory, a temple at Jerusalem. Significantly, the early sources identified the state of rest, or minucha, with Shiloh, and the state of inheritance, or nachala, with Jerusalem, as spelled out in the Mishnah quoted earlier. When the people came to Shiloh, the Mishnah said, the high places were forbidden. At Shiloh, the Mishkan had no ceiling. It was provided with walls of stones below, while the covering above was made of curtains, and it constituted the resting place, or minucha. When the people came to Jerusalem, the high places were again forbidden, and they were never permitted again, for it constituted the inheritance, or nachala. Perhaps then we have found the answer to our query. While it is obvious that the designation of a single national shrine has many advantages, the text of our parsha alludes to something more subtle. Not only does a central location foster political unity, while discouraging divisive heterodoxy, not only does it reflect the unique Israelite conception of a single transcendent deity and its critical corollary of an absolute morality, but it also speaks worlds about the historic destiny of the people of Israel. Israel as a nation has a mission in the world, and our parsha subtly indicates that our mission is bound up with the land. Geographically scattered, while politically impotent, we shall never achieve it. Settled in Canaan, but subject to ongoing external threat, or rooted in the land, but blinded by the materiality that other nations so ardently worship, achieving our destiny will also continue to remain beyond our grasp. It is only by recognizing Israel's existential need for a central sanctuary, namely the necessity for national unity, the recognition of the one God, for the embracement of absolute moral standards, that there is hope for the fulfillment of Israel's mission, a mission that is mirrored by the fortunes of that place. And to truly understand Shiloh and Jerusalem and the stages in between is to realize that history has a purpose and Israel has a goal. The Exodus unleashed a process of God involvement in human history that the people of Israel were chosen to champion and to advance. That process unfolded unabated, admittedly plagued as it was by obstacles and setbacks, even as Israel entered the land and settled it, and even when Israel was forced into exile. Now in repossession of our ancient patrimony, we stand at a historic crossroads. If we can overcome disunity and religious apathy to again champion the God idea and the ethical conduct that it must imply, then the temple at Jerusalem will one day again serve as the meeting point for all of humankind, so that God's healing instruction can issue forth from its holy precincts to repair our tattered world. Ki lo vatem ad ata, el haminucha ve'el hanachala, asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach. Va'avartem et hayarden, vishavtem ba'aretz, asher Hashem Elokechem manchil etchem, ve'hiniach lechem mikol oyveichem misaviv, vishavtem betach. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Michael. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.